From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Marty Moss Cohen, and this is Fresh Air. Terry Gross is on assignment today. Susan Brown Miller's book, Against Our Will, helped change how our society views rape. The recent Joel Steinberg murder trial changed Susan Brown Miller's views, this time about abusive relationships. Her new book, Waverly Place, is a fictionalized account of the relationship between Joel Steinberg and Hedda Nussbaum. Susan Brown Miller is our guest on this edition of Fresh Air. Also today, the effects of innumeracy with mathematician John Allen Paulos. Paulos's new book explains how a lack of mathematical savvy can get us into trouble. And we have reviews of a new album from jazz trumpeter Ahmad Abdullah and the new TV movie, Day One. That's all coming up on this edition of Fresh Air. In November of 1987, 6-year-old Lisa Steinberg was found comatose in the Greenwich Village apartment of her illegally adoptive parents, Joel Steinberg and Hedda Nussbaum. Lisa died, and Joel Steinberg was recently convicted of first-degree manslaughter. Charges against Nussbaum were dropped. The fact that this middle-class Jewish lawyer was abusing his daughter and his live-in lover in the heart of Greenwich Village shocked the public and became a major media event. It struck close to home for many people, including my guest, feminist writer Susan Brown Miller. She began writing a novel about the case the day that Lisa died. Waverly Place has just been published, and it has created quite a controversy in the women's community. Brown Miller is a leading feminist author. Her 1975 book, Against Our Will, helped redefine the debate on rape. Brown Miller now finds herself at odds with a large part of the feminist community. When she first saw the battered face of Nussbaum, she saw her as a victim. But as she learned more about what had happened, Brown Miller began to feel that Nussbaum was also to blame for Lisa's death. Some women's groups charge that Brown Miller lacks sympathy for Nussbaum and is blaming the victim of domestic abuse for what happened. Though Waverly Place is fiction, Brown Miller did interview most of the people connected with the case. She was not, however, able to get an interview with Steinberg or Nussbaum. I asked Susan Brown Miller what it was about the Steinberg story that made her want to write about it.
I think I've never been so moved by a case of child abuse and murder. Of course, this case happened in my neighborhood of Greenwich Village. Joel Steinberg was a lawyer who looked like other men I've gone out with in my life. Hedda Nussbaum, in those first extraordinary videotape pictures of her being led into the police precinct, looked like nothing human. I needed to find out for myself and to tell my readers how this couple in my neighborhood could have gone from people I might have known to such a spiral descent into depravity.
Why did you choose a novel, though? Why did you want to fictionalize your story as opposed to doing a kind of
true crime
investigative piece?
Well, I did a lot of investigation. I have my differences with the true crime genre, first of all, because they increasingly rely on reconstructed dialogue. My feeling was that no one was a fly on the wall in the Steinberg apartment. And since the interaction between Hedda and Joel occurred in that apartment when no one was there, interviews with the principals, even if I should have gotten interviews with the principals, wouldn't have told me anything. I'd have to reconstruct the dialogue. So I thought, why make the pretense of this being nonfiction? I'm going to just call it fiction, and that's what it is. But I believe it's a psychological truth about this case.
Well, it's really a very, I would say, thinly veiled fiction, because what seems to be different are their names. But for the most part, he's an attorney. Mm-hmm. She's works for a book publisher. They adopt illegally 2 children, and on and on and on.
Right.
You've stuck with the facts.
As much as I could, yes. I strung a fictional narrative between what I consider to be the signposts. It's like the Via Dolorosa in this case. It's the stations of the cross. Certain facts about Steinberg and Nussbaum became very well known in the weeks after the murder of Lisa, and I simply strung my fictional narrative along those signposts.
Experts will tell us that family violence really knows no boundaries, that it happens in all kinds of families, in all classes. Is there something of a kind of class bias to be so shocked and upset to see this kind of family violence within a white, professional, upper middle class family?
Well, I think quite to the contrary. We all know that family violence cuts across class lines. But we also tend to ignore the fact that, I mean, or at least many people do, that it has its unfortunate statistical position in the middle class and the upper middle class and the upper class. I think, are you asking me why did I choose a middle class case to write about?
Sure.
Because if you are, then my obvious answer is that these people's lives were accessible to me. I had no trouble working my way into the lives of Steinberg and Nussbaum. Nothing about them required a tremendous leap. I mean, they were of the same ethnic background as I was, you know, pretty much the same socioeconomic background. So I didn't have to make it up or falsify. I knew who these people were. I just never had any experience with people who chose this route of irresponsibility.
Did you identify with any part of them?
As a novelist, I identified with all of them in turn as I was writing about them. Everyone, including, of course, the little girl. But I did not think... You know, if I started thinking that I would use myself for Judith, who is the stand-in for Hedda, it became very clear to me early on, after I wrote the first scene where she's hit by Barry, the stand-in for Joel, it became clear to me that I was not her and she was not me, because I wouldn't have put up with it.
Have you ever been hit by a man?
The first scene of violence in Waverly Place, where Barry hits Judith after a skiing weekend, where he accuses her of flirting on the slopes in Vermont, that happened to me. Yes, my response was totally different. When my ears were boxed, as Judith's ears were boxed, I was standing in the kitchen and there was a bread knife on the counter, and it was near my left hand, but although I'm right-handed, I picked up the knife. It was such an instinctive gesture. I just picked up the knife with my left hand and I said, "You better get out of here or I'll kill you." I mean, I didn't think about it. I'm not a violent person. I've never hit anybody in my life. But I knew that I had to protect myself at that moment, that something very strange had happened to me, that his violence had nothing to do with the reality. So I thought I'd use that scene as the first time that Judith gets hit. But, of course, her response was so different from mine. She said, "I love you."
Susan Brown Miller is my guest, and her new book is called Waverly Place. You make clear that this is really not a simple tale of a kind of sadistic victimizer and a passive victim, that it's really much more complicated than that. Makes me wonder whether your views about women who are in abusive relationships has changed over time, whether you're looking at this in a different kind of way.
When I wrote Against Our Will, I said that any woman can be a victim of rape, and that's absolutely true. An 87-year-old woman can be a victim of rape. A 2-year-old female child has been a victim of rape. Any woman can be in the wrong situation at the wrong time, walking to her parked car in the deserted garage, and she can be set upon by a number of assailants. She can be sleeping in her own bedroom at 3 a.m, and an intruder can come in through that window with a knife and put it at her throat. Any woman can be a victim of rape. I do not believe, and I have never believed, that any woman can be a victim of battery. Any woman can be hit once. Any woman can be hit maybe twice. But there are many of us who would choose to walk out, who would not take physical violence. Many of us would not even take emotional abuse. I think that the battered women's advocacy movement, in suggesting that the victim of battery could be any woman, is wrong. They are wrong about this. And the message they're telling women is wrong, if that's what they're saying. Because it says that women cannot make the same adult choices of will that men can make. It's not true. It's also giving too much credit to the batterers. They are not all that powerful. They are not all that charming, manipulative, and effective that any woman who crosses the batterer's path is going to get sucked in by one of them.
Is the important word choose, and that's the word that you've used. And I suppose a relationship over time suggests the fact that you make choices over time.
Well, that's the important difference between the victim of rape and the victim of battery. The victim of rape is a victim once in an isolated, traumatizing incident that can affect her for the rest of her life. The victim of battery chooses to stay in the battery relationship over a period of time. With Nussbaum and Steinberg, she stayed in that abusive relationship for 12 years. That's at least 6 years longer than the average I hear from my friends in the battered women's advocacy movement. So, of course, she had ample opportunity to get out at the beginning, but she instead instituted this process of denial in her head of it won't happen again, or he needs me, or the power of my love will overcome his violence. The real person didn't do this. It was some other person inside him. I mean, they give themselves an extraordinary number of excuses. I've heard them all. I've heard all the excuses. The bottom line is always, but I love him. And again, that's another reason why taking a middle-class case to examine this reciprocal relationship between batterer and victim was more interesting than taking the case of a poor woman on welfare, where there are economic reasons why she might feel she had to stay. No economic reasons in the Steinberg-Nussbaum case.
In all violent relationships, there isn't always violence. I mean, there are seem to be moments of kind of tenderness and forgiveness and promises. Do you think is it the violence that keeps a woman in a relationship, or is it the tender moments?
Well, you're playing devil's advocate here, Marty. Right. You can't fool me. We know that women don't want to be hit. I don't think there's a woman alive who wants to be hit. They do live for the tender moments afterward, when the batterer shows his contrition and they go through a honeymoon period. I would also suggest more provocatively that at least in the case of Hedda Nussbaum and Joel Steinberg, that not only were the honeymoon periods the moment she craved, I think she felt any situation with Joel in which she had his full time and attention was where she wanted to be. And so she put up with the violence too. And, of course, as she herself testified on the stand, when they freebased cocaine together, according to her memory, the conversations were all about her, and he was trying to improve her therapeutically.
Leaving a violent man is just the way it's a complicated relationship. It's also a very complicated thing to do. And in the novel, you describe a woman who slowly begins to lose any contact with her social network. She stops working. She becomes more and more housebound, loses more and more contact with the outside world. And I think this is also reflected in the real life case of women who are in abusive situations where they feel exceedingly cut off. Oftentimes, mm-hmm. the husband will not allow them any money except for what he gives them. And slowly their world begins to shrink. Their options begin to shrink. And I think it's also true that over or about 50% of women who are killed by former or present partners. Doesn't this, though, create a kind of level of fear and violence that makes it exceedingly difficult for a woman to leave a relationship?
It certainly does in many, many battery cases. And while the Steinberg trial was in process in New York, there were three women on Long Island who had escaped from their batterers, and their batterers hunted them down and killed them. They had the court protection order, which, you know, is a piece of paper and doesn't mean anything. But those women escaped. Those women tried to escape. Those women understood that they were living in fear. That's not Hedda Nussbaum. Hedda Nussbaum did not live in fear of Joel Steinberg, according to her own testimony in court. She also had money in the house that she could have taken any time to escape. Her few escape attempts earlier in their relationship all left Lisa at home. Of course, she was convinced that he was the better parent. But her excessive willingness to submit her destiny to Joel from the minute she met him, I think makes her slightly different from many of the other cases. She wanted, from the minute she met him, to have him be the human god. She wanted him to control her life. And I have to keep saying, because it's such a significant part of this case, the two of them were in a severe state of cocaine psychosis in the last several years, and that is what Hedda Nussbaum was living for. The tragedy for me, one of the many tragedies in this case is that she seems never to have bonded with Lisa. And I think that Joel set up the competitive relationship between Hedda and Lisa, made Lisa his own, as he keeps saying, you know, I was the good father, I was the father. Well, there's no doubt from interviews I had with people in the neighborhood that he was the principal parent. And that until he started cuffing Lisa around in the last 6 months of her life, Lisa adored him, mm-hmm. absolutely adored him.
My guest is feminist writer Susan Brown Miller. Her 1975 groundbreaking book, Against Our Will, put forth the view that rape is not a sexual act, but is an act of violence. Brown Miller's new book, Waverly Place, is a novel based on the manslaughter case of New York lawyer Joel Steinberg and the death of his illegally adopted daughter, Lisa. We'll talk more after a short break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
My guest is feminist writer Susan Brown Miller. I suppose the larger question that this case raises, and your book does as well, is what responsibility does a battered wife have for the battering death of her child at the hands of her abuser? How do you answer this question? And Hedda Nussbaum, the charges were dropped against Hedda mm-hmm. Nussbaum so that she could testify against Joel Steinberg.
In all cases, there is a longstanding relationship between two adults who are obviously unfit parents. They're obviously unfit caretakers for a child, an innocent child. In all these cases, there seems to have been a battery of the female by the male, and later it transfers to the child. And in the case of Eli Kriegmer, in the case of Lisa Steinberg, the woman in this situation did nothing to save her child. In Eli Creekmore's case, it was the grandmother who battered down the doors of all the social welfare agencies and said, this little boy is in trouble. But in that case, they were telling me out there in Seattle, the two parents would go through all the social work programs. They went to an anger clinic. They went to parenting clinics, and they did well. They did well enough to fool the social work agencies. In this case, in New York, in Greenwich Village, Joel Steinberg, psychopath extraordinaire, was able to fool social workers who came to his apartment. He had trained little Lisa. Hedda trained little Lisa to give phony answers in school and say, my baby brother hit me, and also Hedda dressed her in long-sleeved sweatshirts so the bruises were hidden. The cops had been in that apartment a couple of weeks before Lisa's death on a neighbor's complaint when Joel was beating Hedda. Hedda turned the cops away and said, I'm fine, officers. I have to hold her responsible, because if she wished, I suppose there are those who'd say whatever consensual adults care to do among themselves, we have no right to interfere. If Hedda Nussbaum wanted to commit slow suicide, maybe she had a right to buy all kinds of people's ethical codes. But she certainly did not have a right to stand by and let Lisa go to her death. And if she didn't have the wherewithal to act in 1987, she certainly had the wherewithal in 1981 when he brought Lisa home as one would bring home a stray kitten. In 1981, they'd already been freebasing for a year, and Joel Steinberg had already ruptured Hedda Nussbaum's spleen and caused her to be hospitalized. She should have known that the two of them were unfit parents, and that's what I don't forgive her for. And I don't think anyone should forgive her for that. And I hope someday she comes to terms herself, because I don't think yet she has any understanding of her negligence.
Should she be charged? Should she have been charged equally as Joel Steinberg then?
Well, I wouldn't have charged her equally because I don't believe she struck the fatal blows. But if the DA had asked me, I would have indicted her on reckless endangerment of the welfare of a child, and I think there should have been a public trial because I think that Hedda Nussbaum is now being tried in the court of public opinion. The smokescreen that has been put up around her, she had a very clever defense lawyer who rallied the battered women's advocacy movement to her side. This was when they thought that Hedda would be indicted. So they were treating her the way they treated the women who take that extreme step of killing their batterers. I mean, they were forming a defense committee for Hedda Nussbaum. I told them from the very beginning they were making a mistake in this case. So I think it's unfortunate that the battered women's movement has tried to present her as a pure victim or as some kind of heroine for testifying against Joel when she testified in an immunity deal that has left her absolutely free. Of course, free but disfigured.
Of course, it's always easy for us to say what people should do when we're outside the relationship. And certainly getting back to what you said about a kind of folie à deux, that within the relationship, it's often hard to know what the options are because reality becomes kind of warped. There are sort of moments of clearness, but it's also within a system that is exceedingly self-destructive.
Well, the two of them were a system. They're together. They were a closed system. And since Hedda had begun the denial with the first blows, the second blows, when he hit her in the eye, when he broke a nose, you know, she had put that denial in place so that ultimately she ended up at a point where we would say, my God, that's crazy for her to think that this man was in some way a human god. But for her, it wasn't crazy because she had gotten there gradually over the years.
How did your view, your opinion of Hedda Nussbaum change when you saw her on the stand?
When Hedda testified, I was astonished at how tough she was. I think that was my first reaction. She walked in holding her body stiffly. Now, I understand that it's because of all those fractured ribs. Her body is now stiff and awkward, where she used to be graceful as a young woman. But beyond the face, which is a shock that you never get over, seeing that face, the more I watched her, and she was on the stand for 7 days, the more I couldn't get over how she had picked up not only Joel's values and Joel's belief in Joel's superiority, which she was still struggling with on the stand, but she'd picked up the drug argot. She spoke in a real tough New York slangy voice, using all the colloquialisms for for cocaine ingestion. I mean, she'd say, Joel would come, I don't want to imitate her voice, but she'd say, Joel would come home and say, let's smoke. And I thought, strange language to use, but that had been her life.
This became a kind of media event, I mean, a real live soap opera. Do you think that that's good for an issue in the long run? Maybe in the short run it is, but in the long run, is this going to help battered women, abusive families, violent men?
Well, I don't think the Hedda Nussbaum case is going to help battered women because the Hedda Nussbaum message has been you can get away with criminal charges and culpability in your child's death if you convince enough people that you were battered so badly that you should be considered a victim. I don't think that's anything that battered women can learn from. Also, you can get on the cover of People magazine with a kind of made-up picture where you almost look pretty again. As for televising this trial, which did turn, I mean, it preempted the soap operas in New York.
Well, it became a soap opera.
Became a soap opera during the days that Hedda testified. It was only her testimony that was broadcast live. I won't say that I'm opposed to the TV cameras in the courtroom, because I don't think that journalists need to stand between the public and a news event. You know, I think that it's fine for those of us who are at home to have direct access to an event while it's happening. And everybody in New York who caught a glimpse of Hedda live came to her or his own conclusion, and we're all experts. And there are 1,000 shades of opinion. And I think that's all to the good, because it's a complicated case of a woman who stays in a relationship for so long that she does lose her free will, and who offers the excuse not that she had no options and not that she lived in terror, but that she loved him.
Are you a kind of lone voice among other feminist voices about this issue, or do you reflect a kind of changing opinion within the feminist community about women in battering relationships?
I think that there's no point in trying to shoehorn a case in to fit your politics. If there's a case that doesn't fit, I don't think you should deny the specifics of the case. You see, I'm old enough to remember the old left, and I know what the old left did, particularly in Against Our Will. I have a chapter that's very painful to a lot of old leftists where I talk about a lot of cases, interracial rape cases, where the old left and the civil rights movement wanted to see in a certain way and weren't interested in the specific facts of the case. And that is what is same scenario exactly with the Hedda Nussbaum case.
So kind of polarization within the feminist community you're talking about.
Yes, I would say there's polarization. There are people who are angry at me. And I'm telling you, there are people who don't know the case at all. And I hope that they'll ease up a little and understand that every woman who's been battered is not necessarily a pure victim or a heroine or someone caught in the clutches of a monster that none of us could get away from, and that a victim can also be a victimizer.
Well, Susan Brown Miller, thank you very much for talking with us today. Thank you.
Thank you for the intelligent conversation.
Thank you. Susan Brown Miller's new novel, Waverly Place, is published by Grove Press. I'm Marty Moss Cohen, and this is Fresh Air. Next time, Terry Gross will speak with rock star Elvis Costello. I hope you can join us.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Marty Moss-Cohen with Fresh Air. What's the difference between a billion and a trillion? If you don't know or you don't care, you're probably a victim of what mathematician John Allen Paulos calls innumeracy. It's kind of like the math equivalent of illiteracy. Coming up, we talk with John Allen Paulos. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews Liquid Magic, the new album from trumpeter Ahmad Abdullah. And television critic David Bianculli reviews Day One. It's a made-for-TV movie about the closing days of World War II and the debate over the decision to drop the atomic bomb on Japan. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
I'm Sharon Green. President Bush returned to Washington tonight, winding up his five-day tour of Japan, China, and South Korea. Reaction to President Bush's South Korean visit is mixed. Political leaders there are happy about the president's high-profile stop, but they're concerned about his message that domestic markets must be open to U.S. goods. Spencer Sherman has details.
Bush brought a mixed message of praise and pressure to Seoul. He commended the government for democratic reforms and economic successes, but warned that trade barriers to U.S. products must be dropped. Korean officials saw significance in his decision to stop in Seoul after visiting Japan and China. It left the impression that Korea was high on the U.S. agenda. The booming economic powerhouse has long felt ignored by the United States on the diplomatic front. But the warning on trade was poorly received. The ruling party of President No Tae-woo is beholden to farmers, its largest constituency, and farmers are militantly against opening domestic markets. Officials understand that Bush wants action on the trade front, but realize that Korean farmers, not U.S. presidents, vote in local elections. For National Public Radio, this is Spencer Sherman in Seoul.
Democratic Senator Bob Graham said today he is still leaning against the nomination of John Tower to be Secretary of Defense. Graham said Tower's pledge yesterday to stay away from alcohol helps, but Graham said it's not just the drinking which is a problem to me. Graham said Tower showed bad judgment as the U.S. arms negotiator in Geneva and bad judgment in accepting large fund sums of money from defense contractors. The Pentagon today released the text of a letter by a doctor in Dallas who said, in his opinion, Tower showed no physical signs of chronic alcoholism. Tower's nomination was rejected last week by the Senate Armed Services Committee. The full Senate is expected to take final action later this week. Chicago holds its important primary election tomorrow. Since the city is heavily Democratic, the winner in that party is likely to be victorious in the April general election. Sandy Hausman reports on the candidates and the issue which has dominated the campaign.
The Democratic primary pits Eugene Sawyer, a quiet, likable black candidate who succeeded the late Harold Washington, against Richard M. Daley, son of the man who ruled Chicago for 21 years. Despite his father's reputation as a bigot, the younger Daley has fought hard to keep racism out of this campaign.
I hope it's not along racial lines. I hope the press don't stereotype and put people in boxes, white, black candidates, Hispanic candidates. You're doing a great disservice to all the people.
But when he attacks problems of crime, public health, or education, Daley is seen as attacking the black officials who head Chicago's schools, police, and health departments. Sawyer, too, is trying to play down black-white differences, but his supporters have made controversial remarks. One, for example, said any black who voted for Daley should be hanged. For National Public Radio, I'm Sandy Hausman in Chicago.
The Iran-Contra trial of Oliver North was adjourned abruptly today during a dispute over the use of classified information in the trial. U.S. District Judge Gerhard Gesell sent the jury home for the rest of the day and cleared the courtroom to hold a closed hearing. The dispute arose during the cross-examination of Robert Owen, who was North's courier to Central America. Owen was being questioned about a 1985 trip he took to Costa Rica to view the site of an airfield for rebel resupply operations. A group of labor leaders from 25 AFL-CIO unions today said they will support Eastern Airlines machinists in a strike likely to begin this weekend. But the union leaders stopped short of saying they will honor the machinists' picket lines. Stock prices were higher in mixed trading on Wall Street today. The Dow Jones Industrial Average rose more than 5 points to close at 2250.71. Declines led advances 4-3 on volume of 141 million shares. The average price of a share on the New York Exchange gained 5 cents. You're listening to NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. In the 1970s, jazz trumpeter Ahmed Abdullah worked with the Philadelphia bandleader and showman Sun Ra and toured Africa with him. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead says Abdullah's exposure to Africa left its mark on his work. Kevin has this review of Abdullah's new album.
Trumpeter Ahmed Abdullah's latest album, Liquid Magic, on the Silkart label, is an all-American set. Abdullah comes from New York. His quartet, which was recorded in Dallas, includes Texas-based tenor saxophonist Charles Brackeen and drummer Alvin Fielder, and the art ensemble of Chicago's bassist Malachi Favors. But listening to parts of the album blind, you might conclude the music comes from someplace else, like South Africa. The opening track, Mayabuye, comes from an old record by the expatriate South African singer Miriam Makeba. Mayabuye doesn't just borrow its melody from Africa. Its simple chord structures, chanting horns, the whole feel of Abdullah's arrangement are characteristically South African, too. It's interesting to think about the process by which this particular music came about. Hundreds of years ago, West Africans were transported to America as slaves. Here, eventually, African rhythms and European harmony were combined to give birth to jazz. Sometime after that, jazz records trickled into South Africa, where musicians like Hugh Masekela and Abdullah Ibrahim mixed this American music with the sounds of home. Then South African jazz musicians emigrated to the States, where Americans like Ahmed Abdullah have been influenced by their music. By now, the evolutionary trail has crisscrossed the Atlantic three times. I mean, this stuff really gets around. Mayabuye is the only tune on Abdullah's album that has a specifically African source, but the same spirit runs through much of the record. Here's the head of Ahmed Abdullah's Ebony Queen. Of course, the African cultural strains you hear in jazz aren't always obvious, but Charles Brackeen's tenor sax work on the same piece resembles the sanctified shouting you might hear in a black church, an act of spirit possession that echoes African religious practices.
there's a tendency to look at the influx of African and European musical ideas into jazz as something that happened over 100 years ago. But as Ahmed Abdullah's Liquid Magic reminds us, this process is still going on. The Danish jazz guitarist Pierre Dorge has been influenced by the zippy guitars heard in African pop musics. Saxophonist Anthony Braxton has acknowledged the influence of European composer Karlheinz Stockhausen on his thinking. Although the roots of jazz stretch well into the past, the music constantly renews itself, drawing on usable ideas from all over the world, which is one reason why the jazz tradition, contrary to rumor, is in no danger of dying out.
Kevin Whitehead is a regular contributor to Downbeat and Cadence. He reviewed Ahmed Abdullah's new album, Liquid Magic, on the Silk Heart label. This is Fresh Air. Numeracy means not being able to understand numbers and what they signify. Mathematician John Allen Paulos says innumeracy causes people to make a lot of foolish choices. For example, in 1985, 17 Americans out of the 28 million who traveled abroad were killed by terrorists. That adds up to a one chance in 1.6 million of dying at the hands of a terrorist. That same year, Americans had a one chance in 5,300 of dying in a car crash. Nevertheless, almost no Americans canceled car trips in the United States, while many canceled airline trips abroad. John Allen Paulos is a professor of mathematics at Temple University. He's the author of Innumeracy, Mathematical Illiteracy and Its Consequences. In the 1960s, new math was introduced as a way to teach sophisticated mathematical concepts to elementary school children. I asked Paulos where it went wrong.
I think one of the problems with the so-called new math was that it was prematurely abstract. It didn't have much to do with real mathematics, numbers, chance, probability.
Is there still that difference between boys and girls in math? Are we kind of closing that gap where girls will succeed just as well and do just as well academically in math?
The latest studies, and of course it depends which ones you look at, the latest studies seem to indicate that the gap between girls' performances and boys' performances seems to be narrowing. And I don't think there's any inherent genetic difference between boys' ability in mathematics and girls, but they do score lower for a variety of reasons, socialization, the broad reason.
There's another part of this, and you touch upon it in your book, which is that people who don't do well in math or are innumerate are proudly so, and the idea being that I'm not a numbers person, I'm a people person, right. And a kind of proudness in that.
Yeah, it always annoys me. I mean, if I meet somebody at a party or wherever, and they find out I'm a mathematician, they do feel compelled to confess that math was their worst subject. And I think part of the reason is, unlike illiteracy or general cultural ignorance, which people are vaguely ashamed of, the consequences of innumeracy aren't as obvious, as immediate, as are those of illiteracy, cultural ignorance. And people think that there aren't any.
I think one of the things that many people grapple with is we're told about our billion-dollar debt, or I suppose at this point it's probably a trillion-dollar debt that we have. I think the larger that numbers become, the harder it is for us to comprehend it. And yet, if someone wants to describe that, if you took $1 trillion and $1 bills and you put them, it would be so many miles high. Do people who are uncomfortable or innumerate in numbers need to kind of personalize numbers in a way to understand them?
I think not just innumerate people, but numerate people as well. Well, one example I often give is the difference between millions, billions, and trillions is as follows. A million seconds takes about 11 and a half days to tick by, whereas a billion seconds takes about 32 years, and a trillion seconds takes 32,000 years. So it won't do to lump millions, billions, and trillions and say they're all big numbers. It reminds me of the Hottentots number system. They have one, two, three, many. And for many people have somewhat similar system.
To be numerate in this society, what do we have to be able to do?
I think it's important to have an appreciation for numbers, for magnitudes, and not the calculations. You can use calculators to actually do the computations. But if somebody asks you how tall the Empire State Building is, you should realize that 5 miles is a ridiculous estimate. And as you mentioned earlier about terrorists and so on, should be able to assess risks in a reasonable way. The number of people who die from smoking each year is the numerical equivalent of 3 fully loaded jumbo jets crashing each and every day of the year. I mean, that's a horrendous toll, and yet people continue smoking. So this ability to estimate magnitudes, compare magnitudes, assess relative riskiness of various activities, and have some feel for numbers and probability, how large is the population of the United States, how large is the population of the world, and so on. Some feel for, as I say, numbers and chance, I think, are much more essential than this ability to do long division.
You've gone down to Atlantic City, and I guess, I don't know if... I guess they watch out for people like you, people that can count cards. But I guess there's a place where people feel that they can play the odds, that they're somehow special and lucky. Even though everything is designed to take your money away, it's also designed to make you feel like it isn't.
Right.
How did you play down there? How do you sort of play the odds?
Well, I mean, there's no game that you can win at except for blackjack, because blackjack is the only game where the sequence of outcomes depends on the previous history. But even there, unless you have enough money to play with, the variability of the outcomes is so much you may lose your money before you start winning, and the rate at which you win, unless you have a ton of money, is going to be so slow it's easier to work.
Can you count the cards? I mean, is that something?
Yeah,
you can do?
I used to, but it's very difficult, and not to count, but to maintain one's concentration in a smoky atmosphere. It's dark and it's kind of boring. You just sit there for hours, keeping track of aces and kings and so on. One thing about casinos is they're designed so that any win is accompanied by little tinkling sounds of coins dropping into the thing, lights flashing, and so on. So the wins are announced quite clearly, and the losses are invisible and silent.
So how do we make a more numerate populace? And I guess that's a word we're going to hear more and more these days, numerate.
Well, a variety of suggestions. One, elementary school, I think there should be elementary school specialists in mathematics.
And how would they teach?
They'd... They teach in a less authoritative way. They encourage more active involvement of the children, and they'd measure your radius, so the circumference of a head and the height, and look at the ratio maybe of those two things. You'd estimate how many nickels in a tower equal in height to the Empire State Building. You'd get away from this model. There's got to be a right answer, and it's got to be done this way, and you got to do 400 problems, and you better watch out. I mean, there's a kind of quasi-militaristic atmosphere in many mathematics classrooms that most people, myself included, I mean, just find unpleasant.
Do you find a place, though, for learning math tables and the kind of rote memorization that it seems that schools encourage? I mean, do you see a place for that?
Well, I think eventually you have to know multiplication tables and how to divide, but those skills are much less valuable than they used to be. After all, we do have calculators, and I, for one, never multiply or divide. I mean, it's as if 500 years ago, as the Roman numeral system was being supplanted by Hindu Arabic, people insisting that you have to know how to divide with Roman numerals. I mean, that's a skill that's no longer valuable. And it may be the case that we're coming to that now, I mean, with calculators and so on.
I think, too, about all this kind of statistical information that gets thrown at us all the time. And I suppose there is a kind of skepticism now about, and I suppose an election campaign can make you that way, but a lot of statistics are thrown at you. And you say, well, you know, that you can make statistics say whatever you want them to.
Right.
And a kind of a prejudice.
Yeah, well, one thing people are often surprised at is how if the sample you select is random, how few people you actually need to interview. And people sometimes express skepticism about polls because they say, oh, they only talked to 1,500 people, 2,000 people. But if the sample is random, that's generally a sufficient number. What is the case is that many surveys that are reported in the press are not based on random samples. I mean, Sherry Height or somebody in some magazine says, you know, 85% of women hate their husbands and 62% hate their kids. I mean, the respondents are limited to subscribers to the magazine, first of all, but even more biased than that is it's limited to the people who resonate with the question, usually in a kind of negative way.
Hmm. Your book has examples of how much blood there is in the world and what you could fill up, you know, to equal the amount of blood. Do you like to play with those ideas? I mean, not when you're writing a book, but if you're just sort of fiddling around, do you like to kind of figure out things in your spare time?
Yeah, I mean, I hesitate because, again, it kind of plays into this stereotype of a nerd, idiot savant.
No, I wasn't saying that.
No, I know, but to answer your question, yes, I hear something in the news and I say that can't be the case, and I do a little calculation and say, no, in order for that to be the case, this would have to be the case, and that's ridiculous. And so, I mean, then, you know, I usually drop it there. There are only so many irate letters you can send.
Well, thank you very much for coming by and talking with us today.
Enjoyed thank you,
it.
Marty.
John Allen Paulos' book, Innumeracy, Mathematical Illiteracy and Its Consequences, is published by Farrar, Straus, and Giroux. This is Fresh Air. All Things Considered is coming up, and co-host Robert Siegel has joined us. Robert, what are you working on today? Anything new on John Tower?
Yes, we'll be hearing from Linda Wertheimer on Capitol Hill today about how senators are lining up on the Tower vote. Many say they have not yet made up their minds, but we'll hear what Linda has to say. Also, Dan Shore will offer his analysis about the man, John Tower, who decided he had to make a pledge before he could take an oath. We'll also be hearing about a number of women who work for USA Today in Arlington, Virginia, who have had miscarriages and the investigation into their workplace to find out what, if anything, might be causing that uncommon number.
Well, thank you, Robert. And those stories and more coming up from All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Six years ago, ABC presented a highly publicized drama called The Day After. It was about what would happen to the daily lives of Americans if an atomic bomb were dropped on us. Television critic David Bianculli has a review of a new TV movie about how we first developed and used the bomb.
This weekend, CBS is showing a new made-for-TV movie that might as well be called The Day Before. Its real title is Day One, and it's all about the race during World War II to be the first country to develop the atomic bomb. It's also about what the winning country, which I guess is no state secret, was the United States, decided to do with the bomb once it successfully tested one. Ultimately, America dropped the first bomb on the civilian Japanese target of Hiroshima. One of the most haunting moments of Day One comes when the show recreates actual audio tapes from the bombing crew's radio transmissions to dramatize that mission.
Bomb away. Stand by for the tone break. And the turn.
Look at that son of a bitch go!
Reflected shockwave. Bounce back to the ground. Won't be any more. Stay calm.
My God. What have we done?
That mixture of military aggressiveness and sympathetic second thoughts runs through all of Day One. Producer David W. Rintels, who based his script on Peter Wyden's book, Day One, Before Hiroshima and After, focuses on three main characters, two scientists and a general. There's Leo Szilard, an early proponent of atomic fission who wants America to build a bomb before Hitler does. Then there's J. Robert Oppenheimer, a fellow scientist whose interest is more mathematical than emotional. Finally, there's General Leslie R. Groves, who's given the responsibility of creating and overseeing a sort of scientific SWAT team, a group of America's best minds, all focused on the single task of building a nuclear bomb. Szilard wants to build the bomb but not use it. Groves wants it built and dropped, and Oppenheimer seems ambivalent. Brian Dennehy plays General Groves and plays him as a man not overly impressed by a room full of PhDs. Here, in his first meeting with Szilard and his group, Groves makes that point quite clearly.
When you do get your figures, gentlemen, just how accurate will they be?
At the moment, within
a factor of 10.
A factor of 10? That's idiotic. They're unusable. It's like telling a wedding caterer to have food ready for 10 guests or 1,000 guests. Now, just how do you expect me, if I'm supposed to produce a specific number of bombs per month, how do I build a factory based on such imprecise information? Shall I design for 3 bombs a month, 3/10 of a bomb, or 30 bombs?
You wouldn't know it from the Hungarian accent, but that's Michael Tucker, Stuart Markowitz on L.A. Law, as Szilard. He's good, and so is David Strathairn, who plays Oppenheimer. Fans of The Days and Nights of Molly Dodd will know Strathairn as Moss, the bookstore owner. All of them do justice to an intelligent and dramatic script, which ought to leave most viewers feeling a little uneasy. I should point out that Day One doesn't portray the joys of scientific discovery, the complex character of Oppenheimer, or even the Los Alamos nuclear test, as well as an American Playhouse miniseries did back in 1982. That was when Sam Waterston starred in a 7-part drama called Oppenheimer, which was great. However, Day One has a lot that the American Playhouse production didn't, including a lot more detail on Szilard and Groves and, most important, on the White House squabbles about whether to drop the bomb on Japan. Those are the scenes that make Day One really special and really scary.
David Bianculli is television critic for The New York Post. Here's a look at the next Fresh Air. Next time, Terry Gross speaks with actor Michael Tucker. He plays attorney Stuart Markowitz in the TV series L.A. Law. Also, rock historian Ed Ward samples some of the sounds that came out of Louisiana in the 60s. And book critic John Leonard reviews Margaret Atwood's new novel, Cat's Eye. So hope you can join us. We thank everyone who makes Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Naomi Person, Phyllis Myers, and Amy Sallet. Production assistants from Ed Dougherty, Lisa Bruton, and Deborah Beagle. Research assistants from Christopher Cook. Our engineer is Joyce Lieberman. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. I'm Marty Moss Cohen. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.